Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I'm Bob Enyar. Fred Williams is on assignment. Today we're talking about Saturn and the mission, one of the most extraordinary accomplishments of human beings was NASA's Cassini space mission to Saturn. And what an honor to have in studio somebody who got to experience that firsthand and a longtime friend of Real Science Radio, David Coppedge. David, welcome back onto the show.
Well, it's good to be here, Bob. Thank you.
So, and thanks for speaking in Denver recently at the Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship.
Yes, that's a real joy.
That was great. And maybe in a bit we could get to the rope that you pulled out. That's a really
My rope trick, yes.
Illustration, right. But so Saturn, it's one of the outer planets. I would love to talk to you not only about your role, but the awe of the entire mission. Truly extraordinary. So we think of it starting the day it launched, you know, October, about 22 years ago. Mm-hmm. But it started long before that, obviously.
Yes, actually, they started thinking about it right after Voyager 2 passed by in 1981. And so there was about a 23-year effort to build this amazing spacecraft, and it was loaded with instruments. So really exciting to be a part of something like that.
And loaded with instruments as the mission came to an end after 4 years orbiting Saturn, but then it was extended for a first time, extended again, and every time they needed some kind of equipment, you know, radar, whatever they needed, they had it. And the images, the data that came back, nearly 500,000 photographs of the moons, of Saturn, the rings, even of the Earth from out on the other side of Saturn, all phenomenal beyond measure. And David, that made the spacecraft especially heavy, so heavy, in fact, that to reach about 30,000 miles per hour, we couldn't really reach that velocity. How did they get it to go that fast?
Well, we went to Venus. In fact, we looped around Venus twice.
Wow.
And then the Earth, and then Jupiter, and that gave us what's called a gravity assist.
Wow.
To be able to pick up the speed without having to carry so much fuel to get the
Wow, that is truly astounding.
So it took 7 years to get to Saturn with all these side trips.
Yes, once it was launched, it was, a couple of years later, it came back to within about 700 miles of the Earth, got another gravity boost, and headed on out.
Yeah, you know, at the time, there were some activists that were very concerned that we were going to crash Cassini into the Earth, and all that plutonium was going to poison people.
Boy. Yeah.
But there really was no risk, and everything worked like clockwork.
Yeah, it's almost like when you read about the history, you see videos, documentaries of the Cassini mission. It's almost like it's a chapter out of some sci-fi, Star Trek, or Star Wars. The technology worked this incredible precision.
Yeah, it's amazing how much they put onto that spacecraft. Everything from the radio dish antenna, which relayed the data, but it also took measurements of radioactivity on the planet and the moons, but about 13 science packages packed onto this thing. Now, one thing Congress took away funding was for a separate arm that could move the instruments around. So every time we had to point the composite infrared spectrometer at Titan, we'd had to rotate the whole spacecraft.
Which used up propellant.
Yes.
Right.
So it could have even gone longer.
How long was the mission? Do you recall the number of years?
Well, it was 13 years in orbit, including the two extended missions. Mm. And so I got to start on the mission before launch and see the launch, and then the seven-year cruise out there, and then the four-year tour, the first extended mission, and the second extended mission.
Wow.
But there were another 6 years after I left.
And it took along a hitchhiker.
Yes.
A probe that wasn't released till years into the mission.
Yeah. The Huygens probe, it looked like a flying saucer. And it was built by the European Space Agency, but it was a phenomenal success.
Yes.
And boy, there's a story there about how it got to Titan.
That went to Titan, one of Saturn's moons, which has this atmosphere. You just can't see through this atmosphere. But it broke through, and about maybe 40 miles up or so from the surface, it reveals this extraordinary terrain, just truly shocking, gnarly terrain.
Yes, they found it looked a lot like places on the Earth where you have mountains and hills and river channels flowing down into flat plains, but it's very different from what they predicted it would be back in the Voyager days.
Yes, and that seems to be a theme, very different from what we predicted. And then when Huygens, it was lowered by parachute, and so you got the video the whole way down. It's truly in two directions, what's in front of you, what's behind you. And when it finally lands on the ground, and so you're seeing, you know, inches and yards and 100 yards, maybe a mile away, maybe more. And then there's the shadow that goes over it. It's like, what's that?
Yeah, I showed that in the presentation, where you can actually see the shadow of the parachute falling. So it's just phenomenal.
Yeah.
And there were some really close calls in the Huygens probe mission. On the way out there, on the cruise to Saturn, they discovered that there was a hardware fault in the communications link between the mothership and the probe that could not be fixed in software. Mm-hmm. And because they didn't take into account the Doppler shift.
Oh, my.
And as the probe was going to go, it was going to change
the frequency. Right, sure.
And so it was going to go out the window of communication. And so they thought and they thought and they came up with a solution. Instead of having the probe in the same line of travel to Titan, they decided to do one more orbit around Saturn so that they could release the probe and it would be perpendicular.
Tangential?
It would be perpendicular to the probe.
Wow.
And that would eliminate the Doppler problem.
Yeah.
And so it was a great success. And even though on the way down, one of the photograph channels dropped out, they were able to reconstruct from the one that worked.
Mm.
But almost everything else worked.
Well, that's an example of the mission was so well thought out, so well designed, engineered, that they were able to make adjustments. We'll talk about Titan and the atmosphere. You made a brilliant point about the atmosphere and the rope. But with Enceladus, another moon of Saturn, they're flying nearby and they say, hey, there's something going on at the south pole of this moon, some kind of magnetic interference. And then they hypothesize there might be water vapor plumes. And they go and they find out there are, which is astounding. Because how do you keep that going for billions of years?
Right.
But then they redesign the mission, so they're going to fly by. They were going to fly by Enceladus maybe four times. I think they ended up 22 times, including seven times flying right through the plume.
Yes.
Actually sampling what's in this plume.
Yes, they have had a cosmic dust analyzer, CDA, which could actually... It was a mass spectrometer, so it could collect particles and analyze them and say what it was. Mm-hmm. It was largely water ice, but no ammonia or carbon dioxide to speak of, and some silicates.
It had silicates, salt. It had salt.
Yes.
It had organics. That doesn't necessarily mean biological.
Right.
But it had organics, and these things are somewhat surprising.
Very surprising.
But the biggest surprise is how could such a small body be outgassing so much water vapor if it's billions of years old. That's
absolutely
a theme. That's a theme of the problems they have.
Absolutely. And this stuff is erupting more than almost three times as much power as all the geysers of Yellowstone combined.
Wow.
So out of its south pole. And it's a little moon about the size of Arizona in width, or Iowa.
Yeah, right.
So it's not that big. There's only four bodies in the solar system that are active outside the sun, of course. There's the Earth, and Io at Jupiter, and Triton at Neptune, and then Enceladus at Saturn. And Enceladus is the smallest, and it creates a whole ring around Saturn called the E-ring.
Okay, now you are a former JPL system administrator, ground system,
right,
for the Cassini mission. This is rude of me. Could I challenge something you just said?
Okay.
When you said there are only these four, we have something we call TESS, the transient events of the solar system, And David, the moon.
The moon, yes.
The moon.
TLPs.
It's supposed to be cold, dead, and geologically inactive. It has the moonquakes. It has about 2,000 moonquakes per year. The strongest is magnitude 5.5. When we look at the transient events of not only the moon, but all these bodies in the solar system, they are doing so many things they should not be doing right now if everything was 4 billion years old.
Right. I stand corrected. And because I knew that, you know, but
from the
Apollo 50th anniversary, there was a lot of
recollections, right? The transient lunar phenomena.
Right. Yeah. And for many decades, maybe centuries, people have noticed like bright flashes on
yes.
the moon and stuff. And so,
right.
so yeah, there's and activity.
We have, I think on the entire internet, we might have the best list of the TLP of the moon, but then of the entire solar system. What's going on Mercury, Venus, Earth, the moon, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, the comets? It's truly unbelievable. Like catching a landslide on a comet. We got photographs of a landslide. It's supposed to be billions of years old. What are the chances of these things?
Yeah, so the burden of proof, I think, is on the old agers to come up with how these things can be sustained for so long when
yes.
they look young.
So your role, what does it mean to be a system administrator for a ground system for the Cassini-Saturn mission?
Well, I had a team of five of us most of the time at grew and shrank at certain times, but we were responsible for most of the computers on the Earth that communicated with the spacecraft. In other words, we didn't maintain the computers, the onboard computers.
Right, sure.
But the ground systems were at JPL, and so we were in charge of administering them, which includes many things such as software updates, security, providing services and
making sure they function. Just I worked for McDonnell Douglas Helicopter Company, Microsoft, and the phone company US West, wrote for PC Week. So I have some idea of mm-hmm. what you're talking about. It's quite a project. You need five guys. You are the system admin lead to make sure the ground system worked, because that's how you communicate with the spacecraft.
Right. And there was the development network and the operations network. So the development network was where the software engineers would write the software and upgrade it and test it in the instrument lab. And then that would be uploaded to the operational networks where the commands were actually sent mm-hmm. and received. So as a multi-talent job, you had to know a lot about a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to solve a lot of problems on the fly, too, when their computers had problems or defects, we had to solve those. I also communicated with a dozen remote sites, the instrument sites, including some in England and across America where instrument teams...
Were there dishes receiving data or...
No, those were instrument teams, like the infrared instrument in Colorado here at the University of Colorado.
Yeah.
They had a computer that we supplied where they could do their testing and analysis at their university. So I communicated with them and provided the routing and upgrades and things for them.
Yeah. So then when the spacecraft, whenever that I use that word, I'm thinking of a book that you wrote with a NASA scientist, Dr. Henry Richter, right?
Right.
Yeah. We've had Henry on the show. He was one of the first scientists for NASA who designed the scientific equipment to go on our first space missions.
Our first space successful orbiting spacecraft, Explorer 1, January 31st, 1958.
Wow.
And he turned 92 years old this year.
Wow. So. Yeah. He is a gem. He's a national treasure.
And he's a young Earth creationist.
Yes. As you are also. And so your book with Henry is Spacecraft Earth.
Right. Spacecraft Earth, a guide for passengers. And what I like about it is not only the volume of information about creation and intelligent design, but it ends with the gospel and gives his story of how he came to Christ.
Praise God for that. And the claim by atheists, we hear it all the time, that if someone is a creationist, they can't do science. I mean, that's such an absurd claim. And they lament that America has more creation teaching than any other nation in the world, but they don't realize that we're also the most scientifically advanced and accomplished nation in the world. We've led the world in all these disciplines, and they don't notice the disconnect between their concern and their claim.
Right. And it's as if creationists can't do any good science. And yet I have like 50 biographies on my website of scientists who believed in God, you know?
Oh, yeah. Most of the fathers of the natural sciences believed in the God of the Bible, the creator, Isaac Newton. And
so. Right. And the science that's being done now has very little or nothing to do with Darwin and evolution.
Yeah.
That's just like tacked on.
And even the Big Bang, right. We have our list of the fathers of the physical sciences at rsr.org/fathers, and they're truly an astounding list, and we built it ourselves. We went to their original writings, found out for ourselves. We took some names off, like Gregor Mendel, he's often claimed. He was a monk, but I saw no evidence that he believed in God as a creator. But anyway, we have a list of technologies, and we say, which of these technologies needed Darwinism or the Big Bang? And it turns out none of them, but most of them are dependent on the discoveries made by the creation scientists.
Right.
So much
fun. That's exactly right.
Yeah. So when we get to Saturn, what do we begin to discover?
Well, I have this chart that shows that we did 4.9 million miles traveled, wrote almost 4,000 scientific papers, 294 orbits. So we were there for like 13 years and found just a phenomenal amount of information that is going to be digested for decades to come.
Yes, right. So with the planet, and of course, the rings of Saturn have fascinated human beings. And to get these photos and the analysis of the rings.
Oh, the first photos we got were at Saturn orbit insertion, where we had to burn the main engine for 40 minutes to get into orbit, basically to slow down so Saturn's gravity would allow us to orbit. Mm-hmm. And that set off a huge set of complicated orbits where we went by most of the moons. And then the grand finale loops went through the rings between Saturn and the D ring.
This
multiple times.
Wow. Now, was this, you're talking about the grand finale?
The grand finale.
At the end.
At the end, yes. So that gave fantastic views. Yeah,
and that was recently. That was
just
in
2017. Right.
Right.
2 years ago this month.
Yes. And so you're saying it went between the inner ring and about 1,000 miles to the outer atmosphere. Is that right?
I don't remember how many miles it was, but they didn't know. It was very risky because they didn't know if there was dust particles. And if you hit a dust particle fast enough, it can destroy your ship.
Yeah.
But it worked. And then they plummeted the spacecraft into Saturn, where it burned up and just became ashes.
Wow.
And part of Saturn.
Wow. But, so we quickly went to the end of the story, the grand finale.
Yeah.
And it really was a grand finale. And even that took a long time. This whole mission of 13 years, imagine all the history that was going on Earth while all this was happening in space. And I think our culture often sort of forgot about it. It's like it went on for so long, it's just part of the background noise of humanity.
Yeah, but
every so often it broke through.
Yes, pictures would make National Geographic and things like that. But the rings were just beautiful and phenomenal. And that's one of several things that we discovered that can't be billions of years old. In fact, the scientists themselves put upper limits on the ages of the rings and of Titan's atmosphere and Enceladus with its plumes.
Well, I'd like to ask you about Titan's atmosphere, but first, on Saturn's rings, David, we've reported on NASA's expert. They've got experts on everything. Experts on Saturn's rings, where he said, they're young. And somebody asked, well, why do you say they're young? He said, well, look at them. They're pristine. They're not covered in 4 billion years of space dust. They're brilliantly pristine. They're obviously young.
Yeah, that's very clear. They've come to that conclusion against their will because they like to keep things old and they don't want to believe that we're living in some special time where the rings are visible and the rest of solar system history, they were not.
Right.
So they come up with theory rescue devices like, well, maybe some moon wandered into the Roche limit and broke up and became the rings. But that's special pleading.
And the rings are not stable. What I mean is they're changing rapidly, they change significantly while we're observing them.
Yes. In fact, one of the interesting rings is formed by Enceladus, which has the geyser plumes. It creates a whole ring by itself called the E-ring. And Enceladus, with its geysers, is producing this ring, which is being dissipated over time, so it has to keep resupplying.
And which means the whole system cannot be billions of years old. That's another piece of evidence.
Yeah. And Phoebe, one of the outermost moons, creates a ring also that goes in the wrong direction. It's a retrograde moon with a retrograde ring.
Yeah, and that's a whole thing. The retrograde orbits of the irregular moons of the outer planets, NASA, so many astronomers have pointed out that their retrograde orbits, they're orbiting the opposite way that everything else in the solar system is spinning. And it dominates these irregular moons. That's the dominating feature. They're orbiting backwards. And so, first of all, they admit they can't figure out how did this happen? How did so many irregular moons end up orbiting backwards? But then also, they have a very high likelihood of collisions. So how could they be orbiting for billions of years and still be there and not have been demolished?
Yeah, there's so many things about Saturn that were not predicted. They were surprising. And I think the surprises fit the creation model a lot better than the billions of years model.
Oh, yeah.
Now, we were talking about the rings, and a number that you often hear quoted about the age of the rings or of Titan's atmosphere is 100 million years.
Yeah, okay. If anything's young, if they say, wow, look how young it is, it's always 100 million, 10 million, or 1 million. It's kind of
right. But those are upper limits. In other words, it could be a lot younger, but they can't be any older than that. Now, 100 million years sounds like a lot, but here's where my rope trick comes in.
Okay? Yeah, right.
I made a 45-foot-long rope, and I stretch it out in front of the audience and say, this represents a timeline of 4.5 billion years, like they believe, for everything in the solar system.
The planet should be, they think, 4.5 billion years old.
Yeah, and then I ask them, well, how much is 100 million on this timeline, on this rope? And it's 1 foot.
1 foot.
So 44 feet are unaccounted for.
All this is not explained, and here's this.
Here's this phenomenon and close to our time that is that young.
In Titan's atmosphere also, right, when the Huygens probe went out and they analyzed the atmosphere of Titan, didn't they come to a similar upper limit?
Yeah, I talked to the chief scientist of the Jupiter probe that had been on Galileo, and he was studying Saturn's atmosphere, and he said it couldn't be any older than 100 million years. That's
which limit. Atmosphere was that? The atmosphere of
Titan.
Of Titan, right, exactly. Okay.
Because it's being hit by the solar wind, and the solar wind impinges on the methane, which acts like a space blanket around the atmosphere, keeping the nitrogen in a gaseous phase. But when the methane is gone, the nitrogen would catastrophically collapse to the surface as ice, and there would be no atmosphere left.
So the solar wind, even as far out as Saturn, is going to have a significant impact on decimating that atmosphere. Could I add one other thing to when we were talking about the moon earlier? Just, I think, this year, maybe in the last few years, NASA discovered that Earth's atmosphere, the exosphere, extends beyond the orbit of the moon. And I do believe they try to downplay how shocked they are when they find out these things. But so we've made a prediction that that cannot endure for billions of years because of the gravity of the Earth, the gravity of the moon, and the solar wind. And so this must be another example of something transient. It's as though the Earth had a global disturbance in its atmosphere in the recent past, and it's all blown out.
Yeah, well, in the case of Titan, Titan spends about 20% of its time outside the protective magnetic field of Saturn. And so it's exposed 20% of its time to the solar wind. And the solar wind also, this is interesting, it decays the methane in the upper atmosphere. It ionizes it into two CH3 positively charged ions, which combine to form ethane. And ethane is a liquid at that temperature, and it has nowhere to go but down. See, and that's why they thought in the 90s that there must be a liquid ocean a mile deep surrounding Titan. Because if that's been happening for 4.5 billion years, that's what you would predict.
Wow.
And what did they find? Zilch. You know, just a moist sand made of water ice particles.
Wow. They also have inexplicable methane plumes on Mars. And back to this moon of Saturn, Enceladus, they are finding that in its plume, it's ejecting plasma and argon 40, an enormous and impossible amount of argon 40 is being ejected if, in fact, this moon were to be any more than a million years old or so. So much evidence points to young Earth creationism.
Yeah, the rings, Titan, Enceladus, it's all over the place. And now at Pluto, too, they found activity going on.
Yeah.
So that can't be that old.
David Coppedge, I had the honor of interviewing you back in 2015. I introduced you as a former JPL system administrator. You are a former. When you left there, it was with some amount of controversy. Could we give an update? You shared a DVD, a science DVD, with a coworker, and it had interviews of three JPL scientists on the video.
The Privileged Planet actually has four JPL scientists,
four.
And it was filmed with NASA permission on lab. Okay, Privileged Planet.
Right.
The one that I shared with this particular lady, though, that started the domino of my troubles was Unlocking the Mystery of Life.
Oh, what a great video.
Yeah, she took it and smiled and said, that looks interesting. Thank you.
This is as you guys are leaving for the day.
Yeah, and the next thing I know, I'm being investigated by human resources. And
right.
I'm bawled out by my boss and all that trouble started.
Because intelligent design, it's saying there's so much evidence of design. There's so much evidence that's not consistent with our standard model of origins.
Right.
And so that today, of course, that's rather controversial. So have there been any developments since we talked?
Well, the whole story is told in Jerry Bergman's book, Censoring the Darwin Skeptics, chapter 17. So you can read the whole the whole story there.
But that's part of his series, The Slaughter of the Dissidents. All the scientists who their careers have been destroyed because they've questioned evolution.
Right. And so anyway, what happened years after this, I forget how long after the trial and after I lost and after I was got cancer and just the whole bottom fell out, you know.
Yeah.
I'm doing very well now, by the way. So don't worry about me. God is very good. But I did get a letter from the sister of the lady that accused me that started the dominoes falling. And out of the blue, she wrote me and she said this: "It so encouraged me to find that the Lord had placed people in her path that Margaret no doubt complained only because she was affected by watching the video and that scared her.
Wow.
And that our prayers for them are being heard." In other words, her sister's a believer.
So Margaret is the coworker. Her sister believes in the Lord. Obviously,
and
she's a creationist.
And praying
is praying for her sister. And she's so thankful that you shared this video with her.
She said, "So thank you for sharing the truth with her. It was the right thing to do, and that is rarely rewarded on this side." By the way, this accuser cost me a lot of money in terms of lost income and benefits.
Of course, right. It was your career.
Yeah. I was going to be there till I retired, you know, at the end of the mission, but I lost 7 years of good, solid income there.
Yeah, right.
Anyway, her sister went on to say, "I am so sorry that you paid the cost that you did, but I am fully convinced that if you even brought one soul into the kingdom, you will never regret the cost."
Wow.
So that was a real joy.
Wow. And David, you have, I believe, been able to put more time into your creation evolution headlines outreach on the internet.
Yes, I'm very active in creation circles, both with my creation evolution headlines page. And
crev.info.
Yes.
crev.info. For many years, that's where we've gone to get the latest news.
Mm-hmm. And I do that. I still lead Creation Safaris, which is my hiking activity. I write also for the Discovery Institute, and I write for Creation Ministries International. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not bored at all. I've got a lot going, and I feel great, and God is very good.
And you're working with Dr. Jerry Bergman, or he's writing for crev.info.
Yes. Yeah, he submits about four articles a month, and we really appreciate his work.
That's just great. So thank you for having come to Colorado to speak at the Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship. And what a joy to have you in studio. What an honor it is, David, to have you here at Real Science Radio.
Well, the honor is mine. Thank you, Bob.
You're very welcome. Hey, thank you, everyone who helped out with last month's telethon. That meant so much to us. Our website, rsr.org, rsrrealscienceradio.org, and you could click on the store to get the latest, greatest, fun resources and tools you could use to reach the people around you. So for Fred Williams and Real Science Radio, this is Bob Enyart. May God bless you.